Javon Oban, beginning a visit with Debbie. Debbie's report on Tufts and the dental work. This Friday after supper, the 15th of December, 7 to 2. Channel 1 over. Beginning of Debbie's report on the dental work at Tufts. This Friday after supper, the 15th of December, 7 to 2. Channel 1 over. Beginning of Debbie's report on Tufts. The dental bridge. Friday after supper, the 15th of December, 7 to 2.
Going to be down to 30 anytime.
And nobody has got us any water today. Did you? Oh, well, let me have some.
Yeah, I am in my work clothes.
There's a little breeze, guy, but it's nice, friendly.
Yeah, water right there. I can go all the way out there if you want to. I heard all that chattering out there. What are you talking about?
Nupi. What else do we talk about? Walking up past the pasture, Nupi.
You're going to be proud of your horse. That's God's horse, you know.
I know, that lavender colored.
She's never been around here. She's been mine.
So good today.
And that drinking water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, middle of December.
I'm not going to know what to do when it gets cold outside.
I won't either after all this. Why, it's been like this since 1st of July.
Just 2 or 3 days when you first came out here.
It was, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Had the heater on.
Oh, my goodness.
Debbie, what was that? What was it that you had to have a bread?
A bread in my mouth.
Where do you keep it?
You want to say? It's a plate in the top of the mouth that comes out.
Oh,
yeah. I never had the teeth. I'm missing the teeth.
Be quiet. You
this. I gotta go take my sweater off. Yeah, I just can't.
I'm missing them. I've never had them.
You mean you lived without them for all that time?
See, I wore braces for about 6 years, all over my mouth. My teeth were real far apart. This tooth I just never had. It never came in. And I had this tooth, but they had to pull it because it was a baby tooth, and I have an incomplete set of second teeth, is what the trouble is. This tooth right there is a baby tooth, and there's nothing under it, and one of these days it's just going to come out. And I have to have another false tooth there. I had all the baby teeth, but not the second teeth. And after I wore braces, they straightened my teeth out enough so that, well, they pulled these together so there was all the space, and they had to give me false teeth in there.
Well, that was a rather large job, wasn't it?
Well, no, 3 teeth, that's not very much. And the plate, that's not very much. Would have been big if Dr. Schnell had done what he said he was going to do. He was going to cap all the teeth in the top of my mouth and put in permanent false teeth. And I said no.
Now, this was in Boston that you started out on that.
Yeah. Well, you see, what happened was that I had a bridge. I had a bridge that my orthodontist made a bridge for me after I had my braces on. And it broke. A little clasp in the back broke. And it still stayed in just fine, except sometimes when I was eating it would slip a little bit. So I thought I ought to have a new bridge, either have that mended or have a new bridge made. And probably the best thing to do would be to have a new bridge made, because I had already had those plastic come off and they'd put them back on and here they're broken again. So I was going to go to the dental clinic at Tufts. That's where the dental students clean your teeth, and they'll do more work than that, but it's a student doing it, and you have to wait a long time to get them to do any work. So
they don't have much time, then they have a backlog.
Oh, they have a terrible backlog because they do it at half. They do it at welfare prices, and so they have a lot of welfare patients who come in to have their teeth done there. So I called them up and I said I needed to have a plate made. I needed some restorative work done. And when did they see me? And they said, well, it'll be about 6 months before we could see you. And I said, well, I don't want to have to wait that long. Could you tell me a faculty member that I could go to have the work done? Do you have any faculty members in private practice? And they said, well, what we have is the intramural practice, which is it's about 10 dentists, I guess, from the school. There's a couple of men in restorative and somebody in perio and somebody in all the different specialties. And they have a private practice as well as teach. But it's there at Tufts. See, I wanted to be able to go to a dentist that was close to where I worked. I didn't want to have to take a whole lot of time out from work to go to the dentist, because I figured I'd be going a lot to have this done. So I wanted something close to where I worked, and having someone right in the school would be fine. So they said, all right, we'll send you over to the intramural practice and you can go see Dr. Blackborough. This was in September of 19.
Dr. Blackborough.
Blackborough. B-L-A-G-B-R-O-U-G-H. Blackborough. Blackborough. Yeah. Richard Blackborough. That's fine. So this was in September. I went to see Dr. Blackborough. And he seemed like a very nice man, looked at my mouth and said, you know, well, I see what the problem is. I can set you up just fine. I'll make you a new bridge. And I said, well, that's just dandy. That's fine. I'm glad. And he said, now you see you again next month. This was, you know, just the first visit when we sort of exchanged pleasantries and he figured out what he could do what he wanted. And, well, then the next thing I knew, I had a bill for $12 after that first visit, which I paid, and I went back again in October. And when I went back again in October, he took an impression. And I thought, well, this is fine, you know, and he made an appointment for November. And then I got a bill for $50 for making an impression. Well, I paid it. I went back in November, and he sort of looked around in my mouth a little bit longer, and he took another impression. And I said, Dr. Blackborough, how much longer is this going to be before you get this site finished? And he said, oh, it's not going to be any trouble at all. I'll get it all fixed up right after Christmas in January. And I said, well, okay, all right, if you finish it up in January, that's okay. And so he didn't make an appointment for December, but he made an appointment for January 1971. And I went back in January. And at this point, I had gotten another bill for another $50, and I was a little nervous. It was Christmas time, so I just didn't pay it. I said, well, I'm just not going to pay this bill until he finishes. And I went back in January, and I said, look, Dr. Blackborough, I don't think I'm going to pay any more of your bills, and I'd like to know how much this is going to cost. And he said, a couple $100. And I said, well, how many is a couple hundred? Is that 100 or 200 or 300 or 400 or 500? How many? And he said, oh, well, 250 or 300 or 350 maybe. And I thought, well, he's really pinning it right down. So I said, well, okay, how much longer is it going to be now? And he said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to send this plate off to Indiana to get made. And I said, you're going to do what with my plate? We're going to send it to Indiana, to the lab in Indiana. And I said, why? Isn't there somebody? You don't tell me you send all your plates to Indiana. There's no place in the city of Boston that makes dental plates. And he said, oh, but this is the best, and I want to do the best by you, Debbie. And I said, oh, yes, okay, all right. So he sent it off, and he said, it'll be a little while before it gets back. You keep calling me. So February elapsed, and it got to be March. And I started calling him all the time, seeing if the plate was back. And he finally made an appointment. At this point, I was getting a little upset because it was March, and I had started seeing him in September. So I went in to ask Al what I should do about it. And Al was one of the men that I worked for. Big, big guy, about 6'2", I think, and he weighed about 300 pounds. Big. Al always reminded me a little bit of what Henry VIII should look like. He had a full beard, and he was just jovial and had these merry, merry blue eyes all the time. But he knew everything about the medical school and the dental school. He'd worked there for about 15 years, and he just knew everything. So I went in and I said, Al, what can you tell me about this Dr. Blagbro person that I've been going to about my teeth? Because by then, I would scream a lot when I came back from seeing Dr. Blagbro, because he had started in on his trick of not seeing me. I would go for an appointment, and I would wait an hour, and he would call, and he would say, I'm sorry, I'm tied up in class, I can't meet the appointment. And I would go back and just fume in the office. I'd say, why the hell is he in private practice if he's got a class? Why does he make an appointment? I mean, I don't care if he's got a class. He just doesn't make an appointment in his private practice when he's got a class. Well, so I was fumed a lot about it, and he knew that I was seeing Dr. Blagbro. He said, oh, you're not going to Blagbro, are you? And I said, yeah, I am. What do you know about him? And he said, well, Richard Blagbro bought himself a professorship. He got a big inheritance, and he gave it to the school if they'd hire him. And so they've hired him, and now they can't get rid of him because they're building a new dental school, and they need the money. So I said, well, Al, what am I going to do? And he said, I think what you ought to do is complain to the head of the department, write to the head of the department, because it's Mumford, and Mumford is a tough man, and he'll lean on him. So I called up Dr. Mumford, I wrote him a letter. I wrote Dr. Mumford a letter, and I sent a carbon copy to Dr. Blagbro and to the dean of the dental school and to my boss, who was head of public relations, because I thought this would scare Blagbro if he thought that head of public relations knew what a bad boy he was. And so I sent out all these letters and carbons all around in March. And it didn't do too much to Dr. Blagbro, except that he stepped up his campaign and started looking to see what color tooth he was going to put in my mouth. And then he got started. He said, well, I want to do the right thing by you, Debbie. I want to make a good plate for you. I don't want you to have plastic teeth. It won't be the same. It just won't be the same. What you need is a fine porcelain tooth on that bridge that's out in Indiana. So I'd go in for my appointments, and he would spend 15 minutes holding up different colors of teeth in my mouth, and he'd call people in to look and see. At first, he just called in the nurse to look. He'd call her in, and the hygienist, and he'd say, you know, look, what do you think of this color? Well, as it progressed on into May, he started calling in other dentists because it was May. I had been seeing him since the previous September, and all we had was the metal plate, and we were still trying to put the teeth on it. So, I never saw the plate. He said it came back, but I never saw it. All I ever saw was that he was trying to make teeth to go in my mouth and telling me that my teeth were too small, and he hoped I appreciated what a hard job this was. And I'd say, Dr. Blagbro, I know it's as hard on you as it is on me, but I've been waiting for 10 months. So then I started getting really mad about this is building up. You have no idea. This is my personal psychological problem for the entire spring. I mean, I screamed that this was my burden, my cross to bear was Richard Blagbro. Anytime I didn't have any other topic of conversation anywhere, I'd talk about Dr. Blagbro and cut him out. I mean, it used to keep me going for hours on end in the office. Just hours. And so I decided, well, what I came up with was that I was going to complain to the Massachusetts Dental Society. I was going to complain about Richard. And I asked Al what he thought, and he said, well, if you do that, that's really serious, because what'll happen is they'll put his name on a list, and they'll send it around to other dentists, and they won't send him patients. So it's really serious. I said, I'll do it. I'm going to make his life just as tough as I can. I'm going to make his life pure hell. So then, the next week, I had to go and see Dean Calisti, who was the crazy Italian dean of the dental school, and I just loved him. He was so crazy. I used to walk in with that silly little insipid magazine that I wrote, and I'd walk in and I'd say, "Well, Dean Calisti, what can we do for it this week?" And he'd say, "Why don't you print it in orange, for God's sake? Why don't you print it in orange? Why do you have to go printing it in brown? Who wants to look at a brown magazine?" He was marvelous. So I went in and I told him the whole story, and I said, "What? Look, Dean Calisti."
He didn't use brown in his place.
Oh, no. His office was, they gave him, renovated a floor in an old warehouse building, Texas. The poor school is just disappearing into the garment district in Boston, and they gave Dean, they, it's true, it is. That poor medical school is in an old garment warehouse. That's what the medical school is. It's a garment warehouse, and the dental school too, and they've been trying for years to build a new one, but they got funded for it about 10 years ago, and by the time they got around to building it, the funds weren't enough to finish, so they're just building the shell and leaving the floors out. They don't have any money. Anyway, Dean Calisti's office, he had it painted white. This is a series of offices. Deans always have lots of extraneous assistant deans and all of the academic paraphernalia. He had it painted white, and then on the walls, these great circles of primary colors, like a big circle of blue and a big circle of orange and a big circle of red, and from the floor to the ceiling, all over the walls. And you walk into his office, and he had one wall Chinese red and one wall, I think, black, and then black leather furniture all around. He just wanted to sort of wake you up visibly when you went in to see him. He didn't want any sleepy people around. So I went in to see him. I used to go about every 3 weeks and talk to him, and it was the highlight of my month to go and talk to Dean Calisti for a while. We'd talk for a little bit about, we'd talk about a little bit about the magazine, but not very much. Usually we'd just joke and talk and carry on. And so I told him the whole story of Dr. Blackwell. I hadn't told him before this. I hadn't told him. And I told him the whole story, and I said, "Dean Calisti, I'm going to complain to the Mass Dental Society." And he said, "Debbie, that's a serious step. I don't know if I'd do that if I were you." And I said, "Dean Calisti, you talk to the man, you do something about it, and I won't. But if nothing happens, I'm complaining." Well, he said, "All right, I'll see what I can do." Well, another month progressed, and I still had teeth in the rack and not in my mouth. I wrote a very angry letter to the Massachusetts Dental Society, and I sent copies all over the medical center. I had help on it. I composed it for a week in the office, and I had all those public relations people working on it. I'd write it, and then I'd take it around to everybody, and everybody would make comments, and I'd go back and I'd type another letter, and then I'd go around and show it to everybody. And I sent it all over. I sent it to the Dental Society, I sent it to Blackboro, I sent it to the deans, I sent it to both deans. All over the place. And at this, after that letter came out, not as far as I could see, nothing happened. But Dr. Blackburn would not admit that I existed in the world except when I had an appointment with him and I was sitting in the chair. I probably should have been afraid that he'd take a drill to me.
You weren't looking at a chance.
You were. I really was. He could have done something really awful. And he just would come running in, and I had all the secretaries knew me because I'd call his office so much. All the secretaries in the restorative department knew me. All the secretaries in the intramural practice knew me. And they knew, they even gave up trying to protect him in the way that secretaries generally protect people. They were on my side. I told the story everywhere. And so he wouldn't admit that I really existed. He'd see me in the schools, or he'd see me on the sidewalk or something, and he'd run the other way as fast as he could, so he wouldn't have to talk to me. And finally, I was leaving. I had quit my job. I was leaving Tufts, and I told him. I said, "Look, Dr. Blackwell, I'm leaving in 3 weeks. You've got 3 weeks to finish this job, and now you finish it or not as you see fit. But you have 3 weeks because I'm leaving. And he just said, we'll get it through. We'll get it through. 3 weeks is plenty of time. And I said, yeah, it should be. You've had 10 months. Should be plenty of time. It should have been molded in your mind by now. And he started in at that point. That was right down to the finish line. I was really seeing him a lot. I mean, if he had counted up the number of hours that I missed from work that month, he would have owed the public relations department quite a lot of money, because I'd go for an entire afternoon to the dentist, wait an hour for him to show up, and then he'd tell me that porcelain had gelled the night before. I just thought of something else. Dean Calusi was leaving. He was leaving. And they had hired another dean. They had gotten in another dean, Dean Shiram. And I had an appointment with Dr. Blackbrow over in the graduate prosthodontics lab or something. I don't know where they were making the teeth. And he said, "You just come running over here, and we'll hold the teeth up and see how they look." And I said, "Okay, fine." So I arrived, and there was nobody there except a dental student was sitting in the office. And I said, "Have you seen Dr. Blackbrow?" And he said, "Well, no, I haven't, but there are a group of men down the hall." And I said, "Well, I'll wait, maybe, you know, they're coming out." Well, they came out, and it was Dean Calusi and Dr. Shira. He was showing him around. I knew who Dr. Shira was because I had seen his picture, you know. Well, Dean Calusi started to introduce me as Dr. Blackbrow came in the door. Dr. Blackbrow took in this little vignette, right? It's me and the new dean and the old dean. And he just grabbed me. He just sort of walked through and took me in front of him down the hall saying, "Come along, Dean." Nothing ever happened. And the week before I left, Dean Calusi was leaving too. He was going to be president of the University of Maine. And so they were having a reception to say goodbye to him. And we left work about 4 and went over to this reception to say goodbye to Dean Calusi. And so I was talking to him at the reception saying goodbye. And Dr. Blackbrow walked up behind him. And he saw me. And he turned around and he started to walk off, and Dean Calusi saw him, and he just reached out like that, and he grabbed him up and he put his arm around his neck, you know, and he said, "Gee, Dick, you know, there's one thing that I really wish you'd do for me before I leave. One last favor." And Blackbrow was a little pale, and he said, "Sure, Lou, what is it?" And Dean Calusi said, "I wish you'd fix Debbie's bridge." And Dr. Blackbrow said, "Oh, well, I'm seeing her tomorrow. It'll be fixed. And Dean Calusi said, "Well, I hope it is. I just hope it is." Well, it wasn't. And I left Tufts without my teeth. I just departed the next week. I went in to see him. I had one last appointment, and I don't even remember whether I told him goodbye. I must have. I must have said, "Well, I'm leaving. Keep your teeth." But the trouble then transpired was that I had paid him $62. I had paid him $12 for an office visit and $50 for an impression. And I wanted my money back. I thought I had been treated rather shoddily, and I wanted my money back. So I started writing letters again from Florida. I wrote letters the entire August. I wrote letters up to Dr. Blackbrow.
All the time you're down here.
All the time I was down here. Because I came down here and I went to Dr. Schnell, and in 3 weeks he made a bridge for me.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember when she was having dental appointments.
I used to go all the time. I went a lot to the dentist. I used to go to see Dr. Schnell about twice or three times a week, but he did it in 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. He was real good about it because I wasn't here for very long. And so I'd write back to Blackbrow, and I'd say, "My dentist at home has made me a bridge in 3 weeks, and I certainly would appreciate it if you would refund the $62 that I paid you in good faith last September 1970." And nothing, no response, nothing. So when I got back up to New Hampshire, I called Tufts, I called the dean's office, and I talked to the secretary, the head secretary, like the administrative assistant in Dean Calusti's office. Dean Calusti wasn't there anymore. So I called her and I said, look, I want my money back, and I'm going to raise all kinds of hell if I don't get it. You haven't seen anything yet. I'm just getting started. I'll go all the way to the ADA. Mass Dental Society, hell, I'll get all the way up to the top. So she said, Debbie, it's all right. I'll get your money for you. Just don't worry about it. I'll get your money for you. I'm putting it on the next payroll. If you don't get your money next month, you call me. Don't call anybody else. Don't call Dr. Blackbird. Don't call anybody else in the dental school. Just call me. And I said, okay, I'll do that. I'll call you and if I don't get the money. Well, I did, finally. This was in October. It was then 13 months after the whole thing commenced. And so I wrote her a note, I think, and I said, thank you very much for getting my money for me. And I didn't do anything to Dr. Blackbird. But in December, it was in Boston for some reason, Christmas shopping maybe, and I went by my office at Tufts just to say hi. I walked in, and Al was there, and he said, oh, hi, you know, nice to see you, how are you liking New Hampshire, all this, and I said, oh, fine, Al, and we talked a little bit, and he said, you know, Debbie, I have something to tell you, you are really going to like this, and I said, it's got to do with Blackbird, doesn't it, and he said, yes, it does, how did you know? And I said, well, anything that I'm really going to like, it's my Blackbird. And he said, I just thought you ought to know before Christmas that Richard Blackbird has been made head of the restorative dentistry department. And I said, he's head of the department? He said, yes. I said, didn't my letters do any good at all? They promoted him.
Now that's about like my things work out of here. What I expected right now.
Oh, that is just random. Just like we've known her all this time and we didn't know that.
Lord. Let me tell you, we could put her on the Raiders. You know, the man in Washington.
Oh, Nader's Raiders.
Yeah, Raiders.
Ralph.
Yeah. I wish I knew something that I could enable me to get on. Let me tell you, this fella Schlesinger. Now, it's just fantastic. It's just a show. To watch his mind work. Everything he gets into, you know, when I've seen him on television, that's all I've seen him. But I just wonder about his mind, the state of his mind, and how he eats breakfast. He knows so much. And when he reads something, you see, everything in it is just clear in his mind. Why? Nothing ever is clear in my mind. Not great effort. You see, he couldn't put effort on all those things to get them to be clear. So I never would have made him marry an historian. Far from it. But it is really something to listen to. I've heard a number of them. Yeah. How did we get into this business about Blackbird?
Oh, you were talking about the university. Why didn't the universities have somebody to talk for them?
Oh, yeah.
Like that? And then I was talking about the newsletter that I wrote at Tufts and having to go and see William Maloney, who was the dean of the medical school. And see, the first year that I was there, I just wrote a newsletter for the medical school. And then the second year, we expanded it into one magazine for the medical and dental schools. And that's when I took up with Dean Calusti. Was the second year. He was the dean for the dental school. And before that, I hadn't known him at all, except by reputation, that he was
Italian. And the medical school didn't have much.
Medical school was as dull as it could possibly be. I'd take the dentist any day. I mean, not dentists are a dull bunch too. I'd take the dental school. They had more interesting people than the medical school at Tufts. I think that they hired William Maloney to be the dean because he matched the furniture. I really do. I think somebody walked into that office and looked around and said, "Now, what do we need to go behind that desk?" Well, we need somebody about 5'10", balding, gray hair, blue eyes, very balding. And they got William.
It's hard to believe you were there 2 years. That's a long time.
Mm-hmm. In there with all the doctors and the academicians. And I had the combination of the doctor, dentist, academicians. See, these were all professors and the hospital administrators thrown on top. And they were all fighting, all of them.
All the time.
Everybody hated everybody. I've never seen an institution where people fought so much, because there were two schools. Well, first of all, there was Tufts University out in Medford, and they didn't admit that this sort of orphan child medical school even existed down in the middle of Boston. And that was why the medical school was in a garment warehouse. They didn't have any funds. Really poor. They were always on the verge of bankruptcy. They were always raising tuition. And there was the medical and dental school. They didn't like each other either. They were always competing, mostly because they were competing for space. The dental school needed space. The medical school needed more space. And they were always fighting over who was going to have which floor in the building. Then there were three hospitals that were affiliated with Tufts, sort of loosely affiliated because they happened to be across the street. The Boston Dispensary, the Boston Floating Hospital for Infants and Children, and the Pratt Diagnostic Clinic. Oh, and the Dispensary and Rehabilitation Institute were one, and the Floating Hospital for Infants and Children was the pediatrics, and the Pratt Diagnostic Clinic started out, was really run by one man, Sam Proger, and he started it to do executive checkups every year. And they called it the Diagnostic Clinic, but it was really just for all the big insurance companies in New York and Boston would send their executives to have checkups every year. And it got this very fantastic reputation as a diagnostic clinic on absolutely no basis.
Isn't that because it was that it does have that reputation?
It has a very fine reputation, but it's, there's really no basis for it, because the only kind of diagnostic work they ever did was for insurance executives for all these years. Then, well, the Boston Floating Hospital is a good pediatrics hospital, and that was the only one of the three hospitals that ever ran in the black. The others were always sinking, always just about to go under. They never made any money. I mean, they never made a profit ever. They were always, I don't know what they ran on. Floating Hospital did make money. That used to be a ship. It was what was called the Boston Floating Hospital.
Oh.
Infants and Children. It used to be a ship in Boston Harbor. And the ship burned in about 20s maybe. And so they built a hospital on land. They raised funds and built it. And then the Boston Dispensary and the Rehabilitation Institute. This dispensary is the oldest hospital in Boston. Was the first community hospital in Boston, and it had the first public clinic. I'm giving you the tour, the public relations tour that I used to give.
Oh, really?
Yes, we gave tours, built displays, everything.
Well, that's the reason with that record behind you. When you went back up there, they would be glad to have you.
I think that's why Ivan was interested, just because I had worked in hospital.
Well, the other people you said, Debbie, you were just joining the staff at the right time. What was that you said in your letter?
She was just saying that that's what they would say. You weren't a specific.
Oh, yes. That was... I went to interview for a job at John Hancock Insurance in their advertising department, and John Hancock Insurance Company is so big that it's just, you really nothing but a cog in a wheel. They have, you eat in the company dining room, and you buy things in the company store. It's sort of like being a sharecropper in a big building. And they're, what they're doing now is they're building a high-rise office building that's going to be the highest building in Boston. It's destroying the Boston skyline. And not only that, they're building it next to Copley Square, next to the old Trinity Church. And the building is so heavy that it's cracking the church. It's settling Copley Square, and the church is going. And this man, the job that I interviewed for was on construction, writing up news releases on this building. And the man kept saying to me, this is such a fine time for you to be joining our company when we're building this new building. And I thought, who the hell cares whether you're building this building? I don't care. And he asked me, he said, he talked to me for a while, and then he had me write out a little news release about somebody getting promoted from one kind of insurance to another kind. And then he said, are you afraid of heights? And I said, what? And he said, are you afraid of heights? And I said, well, I don't think so. And he said, well, that's good, because part of your job will be to take photographers up to the top of that building and stand on the scaffolding so they can take pictures. And I said, well, I don't know. I might be afraid of that.
Everywhere. Oh, yeah. Well, now, let me tell you. You know, I never knew anything about you. And I was always right condescending about you. She's a little old black-eyed gal that comes out here and sits and doesn't say anything.
Little bitty note.
I remember that. I never said anything.
And you'd sit there. I remember one time you brought your paper out here, your honors paper, some on the row, and you read it or showed it to me or something. And you were sitting right there, and I had it in my hand. I was going to say something by it, and I can see those black eyes, and you looked at. And Faye was cautioning me. Not to be. Not to scare you. And I've had that idea of you as scared all this time.
Anything but scared.
You got over that, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
That's right. You know, when we were you were sending back those posts last year, and you came back, but I never saw you. I said, they were scared. I see, afraid. She don't know anything.
I knew I didn't. That wasn't any matter being afraid.
I was just scared.
Oh.
You had to show up. Well, I wouldn't say now that you were scared, but I know a thing about you. I didn't know anything about you, except that you and Missy went out there and called things over.
But you know, for 3 or 4 years, since 66, okay?
We never talked.
You know, it was all horses.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not, I didn't
That's
go into the horses, you see.
We just, she had trained horses. We just talked horses.
Well, nothing ever came up. I never raised anything. I didn't say anything to raise. Now, see that.
And see, if we hadn't got her in, if she hadn't got her in on that 15th of August, we wouldn't have her now. We wouldn't even know what she's like.
Well, that's pretty narrow margin, isn't it?
how things happen.
Oh.
Well, now look, Debbie, you see, see what you're doing now is some little effort. I guess partly because you work with me, you see. I don't exercise any moderation.
Moderation?
I just don't enjoy moderation.
Well, what the hell are you doing with a shoddy person like me around? I mean, I'm so sloppy.
Well, no, I'm just thinking, you're getting off of this pretty soon. But, you could very well get enough out of it soon. It just takes, I don't know. You see, this is the only way I ever lived. If I wasn't doing this, I'd be doing something very much like it. I never had any easy time. Never particularly cared for it that way. I just keep going until I pooped out. That's right. It'd take me 2 or 3 weeks, and then I'd poop. And then I was miserable until I thought of getting my energy back again. But it's not in the dark anymore, you see. I can see where you're going. And I actually, you see, you're getting a whole lot farther than you probably think. And without getting all tied up like you see the others did. Well, I learned on them. I didn't mean to learn on them, you see, but you have to learn. It's strange, isn't it? You think everybody's alike. You know, one of the fantastic things about Barbara was she could bring a horse to life just as well as she could a person. And nobody I've ever seen could talk about horses the way she did.
That's right.
Nobody.
You just have to listen to some of those good things.
Yeah. And you know, I just sort of kicked myself, upbraid myself for not making some of those things available. But you see, things that you already have, it's like developing film that you've exposed.
Yeah, they already
is. Always banked up. Mm-hmm. What I need is. Jane is she's a workhorse. Jane is a workhorse. I mean, she can turn it out. What I need is 2 or 3 people like that. And she's got radio taste, really. And she always lived on concrete, you see. She comes out here and doesn't know what to do. Too much grass. She's not scared like some. To work up some of those things. And you see, When I work with somebody, I watch it as much as they do. See what takes place. I try to, you know, just like we talk. I talk to you about it. I mean, there's no secrets. It's not private. It's just trying to find out, you know, what takes place.
But Daddy would particularly appreciate Barbara's talk about horses.
Yeah.
She would enjoy it. It's informative.
Oh, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
She'd like the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
The horse people and the
horses. Yeah, the horse people and the horses. And also, just bringing England to life.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
We were in England a good while, and I saw England better through Barbara's eyes.
Oh, yes. By far.
I know my sister was over there a year or two ago, and she had listened to Barbara's tape on the private horse. You know, the Tilk.
Mm-hmm.
And Francis kept saying, I was all over England for the private, for something like Tilk, and I couldn't find it. And, you know, she didn't know where to look. If she saw it,
she
wouldn't
see it.
Well, we should have just settled down right there with Barbara that summer. We saw her. We went to see her that summer.
Oh, that's right, you did.
You see, yeah, she knows.
That's
she's
right.
I've been there. I've been to Till. We went and spent a day with her. Had supper.
see? See? It's just amazing, isn't it? God Almighty. It is amazing. Put you and Faye together. You really make it, wouldn't you? Faye is great. Miss Fortune was
catching up with you.
Yeah.
Oh, feel it. Yeah, feel
it.
Yeah, it won't take long once it starts.
It's raining now, see.
Is it?
Listen.
Yeah.
No, I guess it's just the wind.
See? Well, after I hug her a little bit, she did a good job of it.
I got so much more to do tomorrow.
That looks great.
I didn't even get started on Mont Saint Michel yet.
Let me say, that's just beautiful, that little thing. I just look at it. That's the reason I came back in here. It's just a little short thing. You're so bony.
Yeah, she's getting lean again.
Yeah.
You kept me out walking those horses.
Gonna add another horse. If you go and get freezing and wear my poinsettias by tomorrow, I'm gonna be
furious with you. Channel 1 over. Around halfway through, around 800, and the end of Debbie's report on the Dental Bridge at Tufts this Friday after supper, the 15th of December, 72. Channel 1 over, halfway through, around 800, and the end of Debbie's report on Tufts, the dental work, this Friday, the 15th of December, 72.